summarize much, but I think I'll summarize just a little bit, because I think just to give you the global picture of or the main important points of what we saw the other day. So what we were doing was studying a model which had some original cutoff, and that was our vortex model that was here on this, to the right of this line that I'm drawing now, to the left of this line that I'm drawing now. Okay, so we started with some model where we had a bunch of vortices with some typical size, and then we want to ask what happens at large distances. So this here, this scale is like 1 centimeter, and I want to zoom out, and I could just zoom out and go to a scale where this is 10 centimeters. This would be like zooming out to know about large distance physics. I just zoom out, and then my points in my screen, I take 2 points and they are now more separated. Now, this would be just zooming out as I wrote here. So here there is point A, B, C, which are labeled there, A, B, C, and I try to just copy them and rescale things. So D is still here, but now because I zoom out, I see more points that I could not see in my original plot range. But now I zoomed out and I see a bunch of new vortices inside. So this is just zooming out. Now, after you zoom out, it's like you are studying physics at the scale of like 1 meter. And then things smaller than 1 centimeter, you don't care, you integrate out. Now you go and ask for physics at 1 kilometer scale. Okay, so perhaps now 10 centimeters, you don't care, right? You cannot see anymore. So it's not natural to just zoom out and keep the same very small cutoff. So after I zoom out, what would be natural to do is to make my cutoff bigger, such that my cutoff is roughly of the size of the cutoff in the original figure. So I could first zoom out and then integrate out degrees of freedom to go to this picture. Or we could do it the way we did it, which was we said, first don't zoom out, first just integrate out degrees of freedom and change the cutoff from 1 centimeter to 10 centimeters. Integrate things, so D is gone because D was a pair of vortices that was very close. Now it's inside our ultraviolet resolution, so we just integrate it out, it's high energy physics. And then we have some effective picture. But this now, what I do is I take and I rescale so that I have the picture looking like my original picture. So I integrate out and then I zoom out by a factor e to the l. And of course you can do it in both ways, but I just want to emphasize that this is the net result of doing RG. You can think that you are zooming out to go to large physics and then integrating things out, because if you are studying some distance d, your cutoff should be like 1 millionth of d or 1,000th of d. It should not be super, super, super nanoscopic, right? If you are studying like 1 kilometer physics, the natural cutoff is like 1 meter, 1 centimeter, depends how precise you are, but not even smaller, right? So things that happen up to some reasonable scale, you should integrate out. So if you start with some physics at very short distances and you go to very large distances, you should integrate out things that you will never be sensitive to. Okay, so I hope this picture is clear. Of course, if you really want to just integrate things out or just zoom out, feel free to do it. But RG is the combination of both, as I explained. And now what happens? So if you have physics describing 10 centimeter scale, or here it's the same thing, so I zoomed out, and you have 10 centimeter scales or 1 centimeter scales, and you ask, is this physics the same as the original one or different? In my new rescaled model, if I started some model and I do this procedure and I get a new model, what happens to the parameters of my model? For example, to my temperature and coupling and to my chemical potential under this operation, right? If under this operation, for example, the chemical potential becomes much smaller, it means that when I zoom out, vortices are much less important, because this was measuring the contribution. Each vortex comes weighted by a power of k. So if as I'm zooming out, y goes from 0.1 to 0.001, before they were not very important, now they really are not important. It's totally irrelevant. Okay, so we ask, how do these couplings change when I change this rescaling factor L? And we found these differential equations, which are called the RG flow equations. And these equations mean that if we start with some original microscopic line, which was our initial line, where both chemical potential and where the chemical potential was a particular function of the temperature. So we have a line in this plane. So we start in this green line. And then we zoom out and we flow like this, or along the dashed line. So clearly there is a very important difference. If I pass the green the dashed line, I flow there. If I am to this side of the green line, I flow here. So we saw that there is a critical temperature. There is a low temperature regime. There is a high temperature regime. And we made a few comments about this low temperature and high temperature regime. Which was, for example, that in high temperature, we will eventually lose control of our approximation. Because by definition, vortices are starting to come up. But our approximation was that many vortex configurations was irrelevant. So here we will eventually, the approximation breaks down. But before it breaks down, we could say, for example, that there is a regime where correlation lengths are of order one, still things are moderately under control. And we could, for example, use it to estimate a correlation length that is very, very big as you approach the critical temperature, meaning that if you are close to the critical temperature, it really requires a lot of lattice spacings until you see that things decay exponentially. To the other side of the transition, we saw something fun. We saw that it doesn't matter where we start, we flow to a line where vorticity is zero, where we have no chemical potential for vortices. The chemical potential goes to zero, so we will not put any vortices there. But depending on where you start on this line, remember, where you start on this line is a function of the temperature in your lab. So you start with some beta, and then where do you go here? Well, approximately you can compute, because close to the critical point, you can solve these equations analytically, it's some arcs of circle and so on. But in general, what you should do is you start with some y star, x star, you solve these differential equations, and you go to some point here. And therefore, this point is a non-trivial function of your initial temperature, but fine, it is some point, and it will change continuously as you change the temperature. And that will give me a family, a continuum family of power law behavior theories, of theories that have power law behavior, no vortices, but some effective temperature that depends continuously with your original temperature. So we would say it's the critical exponents here would be a bit unusual in that they would depend on the temperature. So today and tomorrow, we will be discussing random walks. These are random paths in space. It could be in a plane or it could be anywhere. So the plan is today. We will study the usual unrestricted random walk. So that is just a point that randomly moves around and there is no restriction. And tomorrow we'll study the self-avoiding walks, which would be random walks that cannot self-intersect. So they would be something like this, that people like to claim they are relevant to polymer physics. Because obviously a polymer would be a long molecule that would not like to just self-intersect, to be on top of each other. And here we would have the usual random walk. And in particular, with this example of random walk, we will see that the random walk, we'll see a couple of concepts important here. We'll revisit a couple of concepts. For example, the first one that will appear will be universality. Universality, namely with respect to How do we choose to move in a random walk? What probability distribution do I do to move at each step? Is it random in all directions? Is it a discrete choice if I have a lattice? What kind of choice do I make and how universal or not it is? So we'll see this universality. We'll see something about critical exponents. There will be some exponents here, for example, what's the typical size? How does it scale with the number of steps? So critical exponents. Then we will see, we will study the biased walk. The biased walk is a random walk with some wind that pushes it slightly to the right. So the walk is not totally random, but it goes a little bit to the right. Okay, so a biased walk, and at this biased walk, okay, we will study this biased walk, and here we'll make contact with universality. These two are related very much. In fact, the order might not be exactly this. But in universality and the biased walk, we will revisit this notion of relevant and irrelevant perturbations. Because universality, as someone pointed out, is about irrelevant operators, many irrelevant operators, what doesn't matter. And relevant is something that does matter a lot. So for example, for the random walk, if there is a little bit of wind, that matters a lot in the end. So that would be a relevant operator. And some operators could be irrelevant. And finally, we will see that the random walk is in fact related to our Gaussian model. And therefore, it's not a totally random thing that I'm telling you about. It's in fact very much related to a model that we studied already, which was just the Gaussian model, our table without our starting table, the table we thermalized, is very much related to this random walk, as we are going to explain. And as for the self-avoiding walks, in the self-avoiding walks, we will highlight even more the concept of RG, and by RG I mean another example of a very non-trivial or a quite non-trivial RG. Here we will also talk about RG when we talk about universality and relevant and irrelevant, but the RG is much simpler. Whereas here we have another non-trivial example of RG, like in our XY model. We will have some fun tomorrow doing some counting and understanding how we could develop some intuition for counting this number of walks. This is a much harder problem than the counting here. Here it's trivial. At each step, for example, if you are in a lattice, if you have 2D choices, the number of walks is just 2D to the power of number of steps. At each step, you just make a choice, for example, if you are in a lattice. So very simple to count, very hard to count here because you cannot self-intersect. So from a counting problem, this one is much more interesting, and we'll play a little bit with this tomorrow. And finally, we will see that in the same way that these unrestricted random walks are related to the Gaussian model, these ones are related to our ON spin model, where I remind you that the Hamiltonian was just the sum of nearest neighbors of SI dot SJ, where S square equal to 1, and where S is an n component vector. We studied the XY model. XY was the O2 model. When, in a funny limit, when the number of components of my vector goes to 0. So it looks like a strange limit. You have an n dimensional vector, and I say n goes to 0. But we will see that in the same way that this model is related to the Gaussian model, self-avoiding walks are related to the O0 model. Okay. That's the plan for until the end of the course. And as you see, if we manage to do all this, we will nicely connect to things we have seen already. So it will end up being a self-contained nice final story. Questions? About the summary, or about the plan, or about anything. Let me see if I forgot something. RG, bounds, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, it's good. Okay. So let's start with the unrestricted random walks. So we start with some random walks where we have a walk, a sequence of steps, where each step I move by some distance R with probability P of R. Now, what could this probability be? Let's see some examples. This probability could be, for example, P of R. It could say that it could jump to any point whose distance is separated by some A to the origin. And then it could go into any direction. So integrating over should give me 1 to be a probability. So I would have to normalize 1 over 4 pi A square. That's an example where R would jump in any possible direction with any possible direction. Sorry. R square is equal to A square. If I do it like this, the factors of 2 are correct. It doesn't matter. The other way was also good. This is one option. So this would mean that you jump only my steps at step A. And then at the next step, I have another circle of length A. And I jump to the next point. And here, all steps would have the same length. That's one option. Another option would be, for example, P of R could be 1 over 2D, if I jump to any neighbors, if R is equal to plus minus my unit vectors. So if I'm in a D-dimensional cube, there would be 2-dimensional options, right? Back, front, up, down, left, right. So there would be 2D options, and it would be equal to 0 otherwise. So this would be relevant if I'm saying I can only move to the neighbors at each step. So that's another option. And finally, another option would be to say that my P of R could be equal to, say, 2 pi sigma square to the power d over 2 exponential of minus 1/2 sigma square r square. So this, for example, would be a Gaussian distribution. And let me write one last example, would be the same thing with the bias, 2 pi sigma squared to the power dimensions over 2, exponential minus 1/2 r minus r0 over sigma square. And this would be an example of something that would be biased, where there is a preference of going to r equal r0. So there is a preferred direction, and then a Gaussian around that preferred direction. And this would be unbiased. And now what I'm going to show you is that what we are going to see now is that, in a way, this is a very special distribution. It looks like just another random one. But in fact, the notion of universality will be the statement that if I start with other distributions, like this ones here, and if I ask what happens at large distances, I end up with this. So this is what we are going to see now. So at large distances, all distributions look like a random walk with a Gaussian distribution. If they are not biased, they all look like Gaussian random walk.
And the normalization factors to the minus d over 2 rather than d over 2.
Let's see. So R goes to, so dr, R is units of, yeah, yeah. Minus the over. Okay. And that's one thing we are going to see now, is that is this step here. So we can say that this is an example of universal, whereby these arrows here, I mean exactly doing RG and coarse graining my path, which would mean in this language that if I have 1, 2, 3, 4 dot 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 up to n steps, I replace these n steps by just one big step, which is just I go and each the first n steps I replace by an effective step, right? There were here many steps. And I replace it by a big one. That is the process of integrating out. And then there are more steps later. And I would get more another big step later and so on. That is the analog of integrating things out. Next step I should do is I should zoom out such that I can compare things. And now after I zoom out, the natural lengths are the same. And here I am in this picture where I ended up doing a full RG transformation with factor e to the l. So here I did a full RG transformation with this factor here. And the claim is you start with any distribution, you start doing this of integrating out and zooming out. And what distribution do end up here? Here will end up with a Gaussian distribution. Meaning that in your ultraviolet here, UV details are very important. It matters very much. If you can only travel between nearest neighbors in 5 steps, you can go only that far, right? I mean, you can, there is some sites you can visit, some you cannot, and so on. But at large distances, whether you could go just vertically or horizontally or diagonal and so on, it starts to be irrelevant because you are integrating things out. And we will see that we flow to the Gaussian distribution. Yes?
Is it related to the central limit theorem?
It is a consequence of the central limit theorem. More questions? But we don't need to use that, yeah. I mean, it is the same. Mathematically, it is that, yeah. Okay. So let's see how this works in practice. So I'm anticipating all this, but let's see it at work. So as we said, so we coarse grain n steps. So I have n steps that I will replace by one step. And if this distance is r prime, the probability of connecting 0 to r prime is what? Well, there's no approximation here. We say that we are going to do product of dri up to n. We do n steps. They must add up to r prime, right? And each step was with probability ri, product of probability of ri, right? So probability of going from here to here in n steps is going from here to here, here to here, here to here, n times, provided the total steps add up to the distance that I'm interested in. Right? Now, this delta function, I can write as an integral d dk going to Fourier, e to the I k r prime times product over I e to the minus I k r I. And so you see something nice happening, which was that after we do this clever trick of going to Fourier, this product over integrals over RIs are totally decoupled now. Now I have integral dr1, exponential with r1, probability with r1. Integral with r2, exponential with r2, probability with r2. All totally decoupled. So at the end, we get that this is just the integral ddk e to the I k dot r prime. And then just a bunch of integrals totally decoupled. So each of them will give something. So we can write that it is just the nth power, because there are n such integrals, of it's just the integral of the probability of this. So it's the average with the original probability of e to the I k dot r to the nth power. Okay. So no approximation here. Now this quantity can be written. Well, it's something to the nth power, so I'll write it as exponential. Well, it's to the nth power, so there will be an n here. But this quantity here can be written as the following exponents, where I have minus I k dotted with the expectation value of r in the original distribution minus 1/2 sum over mu and nu, let me write and then I'll explain, k mu k nu expectation value of r mu r nu minus expectation value of r mu expectation value of r nu plus what we would call c3 k cube plus c4 k to the 4 plus dot dot dot, and there is a bracket here, and this thing here, what I just wrote here, is what is called the cumulant expansion, maybe with two m's, I don't know. Cumulant expansion. And it's nothing deep. You can just expand out the exponent, expand this in powers of k, compare terms, and it is just a way of reorganizing this average, right? It is just, and you see that what happens is, so I can expand this in powers of k and write some of the averages, and then I can exponentiate to put it in the exponent, right? You agree? Can do it. And when I do it, it's because of this exponentiation that in the exponent I get not just linear in averages, like I would downstairs, but for example, quadratic in average. And you see what happened here? I got the connected term. It's RR minus the disconnected part. And that's the typical thing, that once I have an exponent, I get everything, and then I exponentiate, and I get the connected term. So that's the type of structure you would get also for these k cubes and k to the 4 and so on. Like full averages minus partial disconnected, minus full disconnected, and so on. Okay, good. But now, what's going to matter? The reason why we are doing this cumulant expansion, the hindsight, is that we are interested, if we are interested in large distances will correspond to small k. And small k, it will mean, like for our propagator, when it was always small k, higher powers don't matter, that higher cumulants don't matter. Higher Cn do not matter. That's the basic intuition, and the basic intuition is the correct intuition. It's totally just correct. And therefore, when we are interested in large distances, we can truncate to the two terms that I wrote there and ignore the higher Cs. But let's do it in a little bit more detail. So this quantity here, what is this quantity here? You see that by symmetry, it must be proportional to delta mu nu. There is nothing else I could write. And the coefficient is what we call the variance, sigma square. So if I was with the Gaussian distribution, and if I normalized things properly, who knows if I did, that sigma would be this sigma here. Otherwise, that equation defines sigma. It's the average of r squared. It's how much r squared that deviates from the minimum value r squared. Okay? So that's the definition of sigma square, and it corresponds to the sigma square of the Gaussian distribution. And this average of r would be r0 in the Gaussian example that I wrote over there. Okay, but otherwise, this would be the definition of r0. Okay, so this would be the definitions, and they would correspond to the parameters r0 and sigma square if I was in the Gaussian distribution. And so the claim is exactly this, that these terms here, all these terms will contribute at order n times k cubed, n from here, n times k cubed at least, and they will not be important at large distances. If I'm interested at large distances, which will be dominated by small k, otherwise that integral is suppressed. And therefore, at large distances, my probability for r prime would be equal to just taking those first two terms and Fourier transforming back. And if you Fourier transform those two terms, the Fourier transform of a quadratic term is again a Gaussian, and we would get 2 pi, and now there is this n over there, so n sigma square to the minus d exponential of minus 1/2 r prime minus n r0 divided by sigma square times n. So that's something quite powerful, and this is where we see this universality as promised. That we could start with any of the distributions I wrote there, for example, equal step and so on, and then at large distances, the effective distribution when I'm making this coarse graining is that of a Gaussian distribution. But here we only coarse grains, and remember that what we should do is coarse grain, but then rescale things such that things have the first, in the final picture and in the initial picture, cutoffs are of the same distance, such that I can compare the first and the third picture. Otherwise, I cannot compare. Or I can, but it's harder, right? It's harder to compare this picture or the second picture with the first one. I mean, it's hard. I don't know what exactly is on the screen. So I should integrate things out like we did and then rescale to be able to compare both. You agree? And right now, we only did the integrating out things, joining n steps and calling it some r. So what do we want to do? We want to integrate out such that my cutoff is the same. What was my cutoff? It was sigma. Sigma was saying what's the average size of my step, right? What's the average x squared? So what I want to do is rescale, redefine r prime such that my final cutoff is the same as my initial cutoff. That's what it means to, after doing this, rescaling and getting the same. So what we want is sigma to go back to sigma. That's what it means, appropriately rescaling to compare. Right? That's what it would mean to do what we did over there. And so we see that we should redefine r prime. We should say that r prime is square root of n times r. I should rescale by a factor e to the l, which in this case is square root of n. And r prime, I should rescale it like this. And when I do it, this exponential here becomes, I mean, it's an equal sign, I don't know why I'm putting an arrow, becomes exponential of minus 1/2. Now it becomes r minus r0. Let's put a prime, indicating that r0 was modified now, square divided by sigma square. And we have just to say what is r0 prime, where r0 prime is equal to, so I have a square root of n, and n is equal to square root of n times r0. And we could put a prime if you want to. I mean, okay, the idea is not to put a prime, but if I put a prime, sigma prime is equal to sigma by definition. We rescaled such that it was the same. And so, you see, you remember, this factor here was exactly our rescaling factor. So this guy grows. This one is the same, by definition, after and before the rescaling. And the constants corresponding to Cn bigger or equal than 3, these higher cumulants, they decrease. That is, if I have some probability that generates these moments, after cross-graining, the moments are smaller than they were before. Okay? And we are going towards the Gaussian distribution that has zero for those moments. So how would we phrase this in the language of relevant, irrelevant, and so on? We would say that this perturbation that introduces some bias, so the bias corresponds to a relevant relevant deformation. That is, if I have a parameter in my random walks that adds some small wind to my walks, that's going to be relevant at large distances. I am going to see it at large distances. But if in my microscopic physics I add higher moments to my distribution of probabilities, that's not going to be seen at long distances. So these deformations, changing probability distributions to start with that amount to changing these higher moments, correspond to irrelevant directions. Right? So you start with two different distributions of probabilities. They have the same first and second moment, but they differ on the higher moments. And then you start cross-graining, you go to the same thing. Which means that those deformations were irrelevant deformations. Yes?
Do you just see that by dimensional analysis, or is there a more intuitive way of seeing it?
The way we saw it was because we see that at large distance, they are not important. And that's the definition. But it is dimensional analysis, because it's saying that the quadratic term has some fixed dimension, and then cubic terms, if I fix the dimension by the quadratic term, they have lower dimension. So I could just dimensionally say that k scales like 1 over r, and I scale the first, and then the second term is order 1, and then the higher terms are 1 over r to pi a big powers, and they will be suppressed at large distances, exactly like we did for the counting of irrelevant operators or not. Okay? Very good. Yeah.
Why is square root n e to the l?
Because e to the l is defined to be by how much I rescale r in that step. it's defined to be e to the l is by how much I zoom out or zoom in. And here we say that my zooming out step is done by square root of n. And by definition, whatever I write here, this is e to the l. So this is equal to e to the l by definition of what l means. L is by how much you zoom out. Okay. So let me make a few comments here. Now, the first comment is, if we start with a Gaussian distribution, and we do this, and we compute P of R prime, and P of R prime is the same Gaussian distribution. Okay, let's see, Gaussian distribution with no bias. And we do this, and we get the same Gaussian. And here I want to emphasize that there will be no approximation. I could just do everything. I mean, it's just the fact that the other Gaussians do not have these C's. That's one way of saying it. But the other way of saying it is that you can just plug Gaussians here and compute explicitly this integral, and you get the same Gaussian. So that's the statement that under this rescaling, if I was at a Gaussian, I'm like at a critical point. I do this coarse graining, and I start with Gaussian, I zoom out, I zoom in, and I continue with the Gaussian. So this Gaussian without bias would be a fixed point. And the fact that zooming out or zooming in gives the same thing is what we call self-similarity. So here it exhibits self-similarity or scale invariance. Then we said that if we start with Gaussian plus higher moments, so some distribution that differs from Gaussian slightly, that has the same sigma, but it has also higher moments, it flows under the RG. It flows to Gaussian. And therefore, this plus higher moments, sorry. And therefore, these guys were irrelevant to deformations. That's something we saw already. And finally, we have the bias. And the bias you can see very clearly. Imagine you have a random walk that I start here randomly, but there is some small wind, so in fact, the average is not really zero. So after some time, the walk is something like this. Right? So So what happens now when I start cross-graining? I start cross-graining and I get a random walk like this. Because I joined. And then I rescale back and I end up with something. Okay, this is not very rescaled back, but I zoomed out this green path to make it the same step size as the original white step. And you see it became more stretched. Right? If there was some bias in some direction R0, after doing the coarse graining, this path became more stretched. And then if I do a coarse graining again, I connect again a few lines, you see, in this toy model, okay, it became really almost stretched. Right? So zooming out, what happens is that here, I am in the UV, and it looks like a usual random walk. I don't see this bias. If I am at distances that are much smaller than my bias, I just see things going around, and I don't notice that there is some small wind. Right? It's like you are in the middle of a crowd and you don't notice that the crowd is moving slowly. You just feel like total chaos. But then you zoom out And you see, wait, there is some collective motion. Things are really, even though slowly, they are moving towards. And indeed, as I zoom out, here I am in the IR, and it looks like a line. So like a 1D object. So it's really a very different IR from UV. And here the UV looks like the usual random walk, some kind of fractal structure. So how do we draw this? So we will draw this saying that in a picture similar to that one there for the RG flow, we would say that there is a flow, and under my flow, I'm either at R0 equal to 0, and then I stay there. Under the flow, I don't move. If I don't have bias, I am at a self-similar point. I am at a critical point. But if I put bias, the more I rescale, the straighter it looks, the more the bias becomes huger and huger, the more I notice that there was a strong bias. And the bias flows to R0 equal to infinity, which would be the fact that it continues to grow and, it continues to grow and grow and grow, and the bias would just become very large. And here, we would have a one-dimensional path. And here, we would have our fractal random walk. And the fact that if I perturb a little bit, I no longer have the same infrared, but I flow something else, it means that the bias is a relevant deformation. So I was here, and I had many deformations that were irrelevant. And those would be adding all this higher momentum. I add them, and I zoom out, and I go to the same thing. But there is a particular one. If I add a little bit of bias, then I flow to a very different universality class. Right? Then it's really something different. So here, I have the universality class of random walks. And here, I have another universality class. And what separates both? It's exactly the relevant operators, as we discussed once in one of the lectures. Right? We could even see this very explicitly. We could start, indeed, let's take a biased Gaussian. And let's compute the mean displacement, R, after n steps. And this would be defined as square root of the expectation value of, in n steps, the sum over Ri square. This would be the definition of the mean displacement. You see that if there is no bias, the average of R is zero. So it's better to define an average of R square and then take a square root. Otherwise, without bias, the result would be just zero, right? For the random walk. So that's a good definition for R. So what is this quantity? Let's see. It's square root of summation over I and J. But I and J, we can say it's summation of I equal to J of summation over N. No. Sorry. Summation of I equal to J when I is equal to J, that runs from 1 up to N. Expectation value of Ri square plus summation over I not equal to J of expectation of Ri times expectation of RJ. Right? If at each step I have an independent probability. And now what we should do is write R equal to R0 plus delta R and use that expectation value of delta R square is equal to sigma and the expectation value of just delta R is equal to 0 and expectation value of 1 equal to 1 and we plug this here and we get that this quantity is equal to square root of m square r0 square plus, sorry, n square plus n sigma. Right? And we see that this quantity behaves as n to the 1 when r0 is not equal to 0 and n to the 1 half when r0 equal to 0 at large n. Okay. Which is exactly the two would be the two critical exponents. We could say that this would be a critical exponent, nu equal to 1. And this would be a critical exponent, nu equal to 1 half, where nu would be defined in this way, how r scales with a number of steps. And we would see that we would flow from these theories, one with critical exponent, nu equal 1 half, to another one in a very different universality class, where nu would be equal to 1. So what happens, more precisely, is that here, if I'm considering averages here inside of average distances, they scale like n to the 1 half, but at distances much bigger than sigma, they scale linearly with n. So I start asking, now I have, when I have sigma and bias, I could ask, am I considering distances that are small enough that I can see the effect of the bias or not? So when the distances are large, but still not large enough that I see the effect of the bias, it looks like usual random walk, then it will be n to the 1 half. But for much larger distances, for n much bigger, it would cross over to a linear behavior. Right? So if R0, what I'm saying is that if R0 is small, this term is more important. But then, for n big enough, it kicks over. Right? So again, one more time. R0 is very small, small bias. N is very large. But okay, R0 is so small that this is the one that matters. Right? So it means that I see a square root behavior. Right? 100 steps, I do 100 steps, it looks like square root. But then instead of 100, I do 1 million. Now this one is bigger. So I cross over from square root behavior to linear behavior. Right? So physics at short distance is that of a random walk. Physics at large distances is that of a very different infrared.
Can you still trust the analysis when R0 is very large? Or is there...
Yes.
Okay.
There's nothing in the formulas I wrote that was fair. Everything would work if R0 is large. Yes.
This is going back a little bit, but mm-hmm. at the beginning when we assumed that expression, the quadratic expression is proportional to delta mu nu, are there scenarios in which you would have that not proportional to delta mu nu? Like, could you ever have some tensor describing the theory that would make that would correlate different components?
I could imagine something very anisotropic, right? Some original model that would be super anisotropic, that then the various components are not equivalent, right? X will not be the same as y, right? Then it would not be. It's true. Relate, yeah. That's so. Right. So there you see, if I write R to be R0 plus delta R, immediately I see that that expression there is the average of delta R, because the terms with one delta R are zero, so it's just expression of delta R. And then, so I already said that R is bias plus delta R. I'm saying that around the bias, apart from a bias, things are isotropic, like I say. Now, of course, if I say that my distribution is not isotropic, that I put a bias, but I also put different decays around the Gaussian, around different bias, like the X component decays in a way, the Y decays in another way, the Z component decays in another way, then at that step there, I would have to rescale the directions to make it isotropic first, and then do the analysis. But you could ask, is it always true that it's just a rescaling, or could things be more subtle? And we would have to think.
Can you possibly scale out more and see that it's going around in a circle?
Scale what more, sorry?
Like you scale out a certain amount and it stops looking like random walk and starts looking linear, and then you scale even more and it looks like it's going around in a circle.
Yeah, not in these examples, right? In these examples we saw what it is. But you could ask, could there be other interesting fixed points, even in these random walks? And the answer is yes. Because here we said Gaussians are special. They have first and second moments, and then the other ones are zero. And we said that if you take another distribution, which has the first and second moment and the other ones are not zero, they will end up being zero, because under RG they are washed out. But you could say, what if I tune my distribution to have zero the first and second moment, and the third moment or the fourth moment is the first one that is non-zero, right? And I tune it. I have to tune it. So I have to fix these operators to tune, and now my distribution has fourth moment, but it doesn't have the first moment, for example. Then the moments higher than the fourth would be irrelevant operators, but all the ones before four would be relevant, because if I turn them on, I flow to the Gaussian. So I have to tune to make sure not to turn them on, but then indeed I would flow to another critical point that would correspond to these distributions that have the first, fourth moment non-zero. And there, the naive dimensional analysis would have to be redone, saying that that's my starting point, that my leading moment is not a quadratic one, but a quartic one. So we could imagine fancier things with these funnier distributions. Notice also that there are even distributions like a Lorentzian. At each step, I choose a Lorentzian probability of doing a step. That one doesn't even have finite moments. If I compute average of r to the 4 in a Lorentzian, it's infinite. A Lorentzian, we say that the steps are very big, right? And there the analysis would be again different. This will not apply. This is for paths that have finite moments. Okay. So here, implicitly, in doing this analysis, we assume that our microscopic probability times r to the 2n, these are what are called the moments, and we assume that these were finite. Which definitely is true in all the examples I wrote. But if the distribution is like a Lorentzian, it will not be true, for example. Okay. So the last thing we promised we would do today is see that this is indeed related to the Gaussian model that we saw before. So that's the subject of today's tutorial. So what I'm going to do, I will end up partially doing parts of the tutorial today, but I think the tutorial is quite big, so it's not a problem if I do parts of it, because it's a large tutorial today. Okay? So I'll do a little bit. So first, I want to remind you that the Gaussian model We had two things that we said about the Gaussian model. Large distances, where we said the details of the lattice are not important. It doesn't matter if it's nearest neighbors or next to nearest neighbors. This will all just change the effective mass. Or short distance, where it does. And in fact, it's quite cute that here, this relation to the Gaussian model is even true even at short distances. But then it would matter which distribution we start. So we are going to start now with that probability there, where at each step of the random walk, I just jump to the neighbors. And we will see that that is related to our table, where the springs are just connecting to the atoms, the nearby atoms of the table. Okay? And if my random walk could jump neighbors and nearest neighbors, it would be related to the table where I would connect the neighbors and nearest neighbor atoms of my table.
Two degrees of freedom or just one?
With just 1 degree of freedom. Just our original table. Okay? So what we want to study now is that example, as I said, where we have some lattice. It doesn't need to be a two-dimensional lattice. It can be an hypercube. And at each step, I jump only to the neighbors. So I can do a random walk by jumping only between neighbors. So I do a random walk like this. Okay? So at each time, I choose with probability equal to 1 over 2d, where d is the dimension. Right? So let me show you a cute formula that looks mysterious and that is very simple. What's the probability of going to distance r in n steps? So naively, if you think a bit, okay, it's 1 over 2d, and you want to go, say, to this position r, starting from the origin 0. What's the probability of going there in n steps? It's not totally obvious, but I'm going to write what it is, and you will see what it is. I'm going to write the following. It's equal, let me write and then I will explain, to the integral ddk over 2 pi to the d, e to the minus I kr, and then I'm going to write like this, 1 over 2d e to the I k l sum over l, and then another factor, the same factor, and I put the same factors n times. Okay. So let's explain why this is correct. Right? There is an argument that if you follow my argument, it's obvious that this expression is correct. Because you see that I'm integrating over k, e to the minus I kr, and then I have here a bunch of exponentials of k. But the integral e to the I k r is delta of r, right? The integral over k. So when I expand out the exponentials, these exponentials here in these square brackets better add up to r. If they don't add up to r, the integral gives me 0, the integral over k, right? So what I'm doing is, from each factor, this sum over L, L was, this sum is 1 over 2d times going up, plus 1 over 2d times going right, plus etc. And you have all options here, right? And then you have the same thing here. This is the same thing. It's 1 over 2d times going up, plus 1 over 2d going right, plus all options. And you open up, so you take, say, up from the first step, up from the second step, right from the third step, etc., etc., etc. And that gives me a sequence of steps. And they must add up to r, otherwise I get 0. So this just counts how many paths there are that connect 0 to r. And for each path, I multiply by the probability of that happening, which is 1 over 2D. So that's correct. Okay? So it's true. It is just counting paths, and for each path, multiplying it by 1 over 2D to the number of steps. Okay? So I don't know. I find it super cute. So this is just a true expression. For example, you notice right away that if the distance is bigger than the number of steps, I cannot do it, right? If I have 10 steps and the distance is 100, I can never take from 10 exponentials of unit size. I can never get e to the 100, so the probability is 0. Okay, obvious, because I cannot go that far, and I can just not do it, right? Okay, so this is just equal to the integral d dk over 2 pi to the d e to the minus I kr times 1 over d cosine kx plus 1 over d cosine ky. If there are more than two directions, there will be a few more. To the power n, right? All these factors are the same, so we just raise them to the power n. So it is just this simple integral representation is what the probability is. Right? This is, by the way, one argument to getting at this expression. In the tutorial, you will arrive at this exactly same expression from a very different argument. But this one works. And now, for example, now I want to do two things with this. One is notice that this is equal at large distances. At large distances, r is very large. So the momentum k is very small. So this becomes equal to the integral d dk e to the minus I kr. And the momentum is very small, so this becomes 1 minus some coefficient times k square when I expand those cosines to the power n. And this is e to the minus n some coefficient times k square. And all this is a Gaussian of R. And that's universality that we saw before applied to a particular case. Universality. And I did it super fast because this is one of the points in the tutorial. It showed that this probability is a Gaussian. Okay? Okay, so this is how you do it, but you can do it much slower. Okay? So we see that we start with this. And we get a Gaussian. But let's think a little bit more, because we also see that it was not so important that the steps were nearest neighbors. How would you change this derivation if it was not just nearest neighbors, but if you could jump, say, here, 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 and here, but also, say, you could jump to these squares with some other probability? You would just add p times this going up, down, la, na, na, plus p prime times going to the diagonal. Right? And it will be exactly the same expression with p times up, down, left, right, and p prime with the diagonal. And then what happens at small k? You just expand and you just care about the quadratic term. So exactly like before, at large distance doesn't matter if it's nearest neighbors or next to nearest neighbors. It's all about small momentum, and all we care is about the expansion at small momenta of this. Right? So nothing significant would change if I would go from nearest neighbors to next to nearest neighbors or to this further down. I just change, I add a few terms there. And then at large distances, they all go wash away. And all that matters is what is the coefficient of k squared. That's the only thing that survives at large distances, and that's again the notion of universality, or the notion that if you coarse grain, you only care about these parameters. But it's cool, because now you see that example. So you see that if I define G, and now I define the following generating function, I say that I'll put some chemical potential mu, and I'll define this correlation function here, G of mu and R, to be equal to the sum over paths mu to the n times the probability of in n steps going to R. In other words, instead of working at fixed n, I work at fixed chemical potential. But now you see what happens when I sum. I can put this sum inside the integral over momenta. So I can put this sum here. And I'm summing something to the power n. So it is just geometric sum. So it is just 1 over 1 minus this. Right? But these cosines are just sine squares of k over 2, which was what we had in our propagator. So this is exactly equal to our Gaussian propagator. No approximation. With some effective mass, m effective, that will depend on mu, and that you will compute in the tutorial, but it's obvious that such a relation exists, and the same distance r. And that's the promised relation between, that's one way of seeing this promised relation between the Gaussian model and our random walk. And then the Gaussian the Gaussian propagator became 1 over k square plus m square at large distances, and we did not care about details. And that's exactly what we saw here, that all probabilities become Gaussian, and we have universality. And the two are just the counterparts of each other.
Sorry. In the Gaussian, in the table case, we had the full statistical physics formalism in the language of partition functions and energies and entropies. How do we define related concepts in this side of the analogy? Do random walks have an associated sense of entropy or?
So I could say that this quantity here that I'm defining here is like a partition function where I sum over mu to the n, which is some chemical potential. And what would replace the partition function at fixed n would now be, say, this probability.
Okay, but would you identify that with the propagator?
Yes.
Which is like a correlation function, not a partition function.
Right. That's true. So here I said that there is a relation, but I didn't, for example, we could ask, can I compute a partition function of the Gaussian model as some sum of random walks, for example, and stuff like this? And the answer is yes, you can do it. But that goes beyond of what I want to do here. I just want to point out that there is a relation. We can see it clearly because we start seeing that some quantities are mapped directly one to each other. In the Gaussian propagator, we saw that we had some irrelevant operators and some relevant operators that match the counting. But the question of whether can I write the Gaussian model, can I expand down and write these loops, we saw that in the high temperature we could. In the high temperature, it was just a sum of loops. It did not matter if they intersected or not. So it's very tempting to think that perhaps I could reformulate fully the Gaussian model just using random walks and trading Feynman diagrams by random walks, trading integrating over fields by random walks, doing everything with random walks. And indeed, you can, but it becomes more complicated. You don't simplify your life. It's a dual formulation again, but a more complicated than the one we started with. But you could do it. Okay. But random walks are interested by itself by other reasons. So in the random walk language, these are the kind of things you are interested in. And that's why I exposed the duality between this and between this. Okay. We could stop earlier, as usual. Maybe we stop earlier today, and it's a way to make up for the few minutes that we might have gone over one or twice. So we'll end 10 minutes earlier today, and tomorrow we'll come back with self-avoiding walks. Let me just say one thing for the tutorial today, is that the following trick is useful. In the ON model with n equal to 0, you have to compute something like this, beta j, sum over neighbors, I and j, si dot sj. And the following trick is useful is to notice that this is just the product over I and j, that's obvious, of this, right, without the product. But it's useful to just expand out the exponential. Sum over k, 1 over k factorial, minus beta j to the k, beta j to the k, si, sj to the k. So something as strange as this, of taking an exponential and expanding it, is useful for the problem. Okay. Otherwise, I think the problem might be a bit too hard. So this is a good trick. Okay, so see you tomorrow.